Welcome to the CSIS podcast, a look at the week's news and foreign policy through the eyes of the experts at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. I'm Colin Quinn. The world snapped to attention this week on the growing refugee crisis that has laid itself at Europe's doorstep. Shocking images of the scale of the crisis emerged, only matched by the appalling circumstances that these people are fleeing. The response from governments across Europe has been mixed, with Germany promising to take in as many as 800,000 people, while Hungary closes its borders. To get a sense of the scale of this issue and what can be done, we're joined by Sarah Mendelson, co-director of our Human Rights Initiative here at CSIS.
First of all, every time you see the word migrant, I want you to think about humans, people, and people fleeing war. You're absolutely right. This is a refugee crisis, but it's also a governance crisis. This is not something that experts didn't predict. People have been warning about this. Organizations have been warning about this. But these people are fleeing because of a total breakdown in governance and safety. It's not about economic issues. It's about war in Syria, in Iraq, Eritrea, Libya, Afghanistan. But it's also becoming a political crisis, obviously, for leaders in a number of countries because there's no consistent frame in how countries are responding. And what we're seeing in Hungary in particular is in many ways an extension of the politics of fear that the Hungarian government has been practicing, and xenophobia, and it's extremely dangerous. On the other hand, we also see a groundswell of people being interested in this, whether it's the 11,000 in Iceland saying that they would welcome, petitions in the UK and in the United States, political parties in Canada picking this up. So I think people are generally responding in much of Europe and North America to people on the move.
And how important are words in this? The difference that you keep seeing is migrants versus refugees. How important is that in terms of how these people end up getting treated when they do get some port of safety?
Well, words are extremely important, and I would say including hate speech. I was reading today that some tabloids in Britain had used the word cockroaches, which takes you back to how the Nazis talked about Jews, to language that was used in Rwanda before the genocide. I think that migrant and migrant crisis, this is about migration, but the nature of it is extremely important, and that's where the issue of people fleeing war and seeking asylum and becoming refugees and what that means in a legal context. These people have a right to dignity, to protection. There are conventions and laws. They can't be sent back to their country. In many cases, we're talking about Syria because of clearly a threat to their lives.
And the political end of this obviously is so apparent, because you see different sides. You see Germany, who's showing really strong leadership and is, again, dealing with the European crisis almost by itself. And then you see Hungary, who's taking the complete opposite and is sealing its borders and not letting its trains move out. Is there, beyond popular pressure, what kind of pressure can the international community bring to try and bring some sort of a cohesive look at the crisis right now?
Well, clearly the European Union has to both understand what its obligations are and have a new and different policy. The way in which it's responded has been piecemeal, and there needs to be a distribution of refugees. But let's also understand what the numbers are. I mean, on one level, it's a crisis because people are dying, but it's not a crisis in terms of the numbers, and I think it's important to have some understanding of this. The population of the European Union is about 500 million, 503 million. We're talking about, I think the estimates are about 340,000 over the last year coming from both the Western Mediterranean and the East, the Aegean Sea. Those are relatively small numbers. Overall, over the last year, there's a whole unseen crisis that's going on, and that is in terms of internally displaced people. So people talk about the number 60 million, which is enormous, right? 60 million that are in forced displacement. About 20 million of those are a refugee population. There's 22 million. There's 38 million that are internally displaced worldwide. So what terrifies me is while I see these horrible images from Hungary, what's going on actually inside Syria? I mean, that's in many ways even more terrifying. But so the numbers, my sense is these numbers are, we can deal with this if we have a policy, if we have people, countries understanding what their obligations are, and having some kind of way of processing people.
Take up that internally displaced people issue, the IDPs. You know, we talk about countries outside of Syria and in Europe trying to do something. What can be done to help the people within those countries? I mean, there obviously needs to be some sort of funding. How do you even operate in a zone where there's war going on?
Well, the fact is the U.S., my former employer, USAID, has been. There's been about $4 billion of humanitarian assistance, much of which has actually been dispersed inside Syria. There are many organizations that are affiliated with the United Nations that are working inside. But the truth is the IDP issue falls a bit in the cracks, right? There's a UN agency that deals with refugees, but IDPs, there's not really an international face or a point of contact for IDPs, and I think that that's something that's probably going to have to be addressed going forward. And there are opportunities. I mean, in next May, there's a World Humanitarian Summit. Obviously, we can't wait till then, but I think there is a growing groundswell for a paradigm shift that, you know, coming out of World War II, we had a refugee convention, and we have a way of understanding and legal obligations having to do with refugees. But I think we're going to have to go back and really think about how do you engage also on this the forced displacement of people that are inside states where states are not taking responsibility for them.
Well, yeah, how much is what's happening today shaped then by, say, these conventions, say the 1951 Refugee Convention? You know, does that still stand up today as a model to follow?
Yes, and the shadow of World War II has, I think people are really reading what's going on in many ways because of what happened in the past. The truth is there are legal and humanitarian structures that emerged from World War II. What's so striking about Hungary's response is they're acting as if those conventions, those laws do not exist. Those laws and conventions that came out of World War II were specifically to avoid this kind of situation. But I also think it is becoming, and it's shocked the consciousness of people. It's become personal for people. I mean, my own story, my father came to Canada on a boat seeking accommodation. They couldn't come to the United States because this is, you know, 94 years ago, 1921, there was a quota on a sudden emergency immigration quota. So they went to Canada. If Canada hadn't been accommodating, I wouldn't be here today. So I think this is true for so many people. I mean, you know, the United States is built on the land of immigrants. And so people, I think, are beginning to think about their own story and what would have happened if there wasn't the compassion and sense of morality that this situation demands.
You know, conflict in Syria has been happening for years.
4 years.
For 4 years, yes. Why do you think it's resonating so heavily now?
Well, I think for a variety of reasons, the population is, you can't avoid it. You're seeing it. It's showing up on your doorstep. For a long time, I think people thought this is far away. But if you have, it's now in Europe. For a variety of reasons, and there's that. But I want to say that I think that this is also an opportunity to broaden constituencies that are thinking about both refugees, internally displaced people, the forced displacement of people in general, broadening those who are thinking about people on the move. I'm sure your Facebook page, my Facebook page, filled with people wanting to do something. And the good news is there are organizations that one can contribute to that are addressing this issue. So I think we may have turned a corner. I'm very conscious that I see this a lot in the work I do, whether it's Bring Back Our Girls in Boko Haram or the crisis in Ukraine and the downing of the Malaysian airliner with civilians on it. You know, news organizations turn to other stories, but I think we can expect over the next several years there are going to be more people fleeing both Syria, Eritrea, Libya, and that the international community is going to need to have a more robust and pragmatic, practical response to providing protection when people are coming, and understanding what their legal obligations are to protect and provide services for these people. And let's not forget, when we talk about people, there are a lot of children. These are children that are fleeing war, and again, international organizations and conventions that are there to protect them.
Vladimir Putin, who is speaking this week, has blamed the West for this, has blamed, you know, Western policies in the Middle East is directly responsible for all this. And, you know, that's, I guess, to be expected from Vladimir Putin to say that. But how much of this could have been prevented, do you think? It's hard to play that game right now, but is there something that we can learn from this as to how to go about so something like this doesn't happen again?
The Russian complicity in the Syrian crisis has been documented. The role of both Russia at the Security Council, but also in terms of political support for Assad, in terms of arms supplies. There's some stories surfacing this week, I don't know if they're true, that there have actually been Russian military deployed. So I think that there's no end to the speculation of what would this have looked like. And it's a question I ask myself often, what would this have looked like if Putin weren't there? And you'd still have perhaps China also vetoing at the Security Council. But there's no question that Russian complicity in these crimes is clear. I guess the last thing I would say is we've read in the newspapers that funding for the response, specifically to Syria, has gone down while the crisis has gone up. It's also the case that organizations that have long worked on issues having to do with migration, including the MacArthur Foundation, have decided to, in the coming years, end that work stream. I'm not privy to the reasons why they chose to do that, but I think organizations that are engaged in the protection and promotion of human rights, everybody needs to be rethinking how they think about and do work in terms of human rights and humanitarian emergencies. Generally, it has been the case that those that work on humanitarian assistance and those that work on human rights, at least in capitals, don't always coordinate and collaborate. In the field, I think it's different, but in Washington, for example, there are silos, and we need to break down those silos and have much greater coordination and collaboration.
That was Sarah Mendelson bringing us to the end of this week's show. And for more, you can always visit css.org. Until next week, I'm Colm Quinn. Thanks for listening.